So after the excellent introduction by Felix and Jim, I have to talk a little shorter than I expected. And this is our site. Woomera is 500 kilometers from the million population city Adelaide. We go here to Woomera by bus. There's a regular bus service available. And this is our first telescope, the Meter Telescope. And the kangaroo stands for Collaboration Australia and Nippon. Nippon is a Japanese pronunciation of Japan for a gamma ray observatory in the outback. Outback is a word that represents this kind of desert area.
There's also a steakhouse here.
Go that way.
Which is very good.
Right. And now Kangaroo is a team of 14 institutions from Australia and Japan. And there are about 40 people in this collaboration. And before I talk on the results, I just briefly give a impression of the history of our experiment. You know, the history starts when the supernova 1987A exploded in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And then there was an international collaboration called JANSOS was formed to search for ultra high energy gamma rays from supernova remnant. It was on the Black Birch Mountain in South Island of New Zealand. It was a height of 1,600 meters above sea level. There was a shower particle detector array and three fixed Cherenkov telescopes were installed. Each telescope, Cherenkov telescopes was 2 meters in diameter, and this is a fixed type. So for drift scan mode, there are photomultipliers are in line so that a supernova remnant can transit along this way. But this is only a counting rate experiment. So if we think of our improved array, it's just a very preliminary experiment. But for this experiment, Japanese people decided to go southern hemisphere, and in 1990, 3.8 meter telescope was constructed. And why we choose Woomera as a site? Here's some explanation. New Zealand was too wet and no many clear nights, so we could spend at mountain uselessly. Many nights, so we decided to go to Woomera. It was a former rocket range, and there was a large area of prohibited site, and infrastructure was there, and support center was there. And also, Adelaide Group was operating Big Rock Telescope. And it was a bicentennial gamma ray telescope. It was a kind of celebration of Australia's 200 years old. And it was a Durham type Cherenkov triple coincidence mode telescope. And the diameter was about 4 meters. And then we moved our 3.8 meter telescope from Dodaira Mountain, Japanese astronomical observatory. It was a lunar ranging telescope of 3.8 meter in diameter, and we set an imaging camera at the prime focus of this telescope. And these are the founder, Tadashi Kifune and John Patterson. So here is a summary of Kangaroo 1 telescope, 3.8 meter telescope. Although we published many publications claiming signals. Later, Hess set some upper limits on several of these sources, like supernova 1006 and GSR 1706 on Vela, as Felix explained yesterday. But one mention is that we saw the GSR 1509, which is inside of the supernova remnant, MSH 15-052. It was, the observation was in 1997 with a 3.8 meter telescope. The signal was only a 4 sigma, so we could not claim a detection, but and here's a significance map. But maybe this could be a detection if we think of the Hess new results. Then our new Kangaroo telescope was constructed in 1999, and it was first built as a 7-meter telescope, but 1 year later it was upgraded to a 10-meter in diameter. It was a segmented mirror with a 114 80-centimeter carbon fiber reinforced plastic mirrors. Mirror segments, and each mirror was the main base was a CFRP plastic, but the surface is a aluminum surface, so the reflectivity is not as bad as the plastic surface. And the imaging camera was 552 channels, but the diameter of this camera was around 2.7 degrees, smaller than our newer telescopes.
Masaki, why do you have 8-meter focal length?
8-meter. So this telescope design was taken from a radio antenna. So Mitsubishi engineers wondered if we put camera further away, the moment is not good for this kind of mount. And now this 10-meter telescope is one of the four telescopes of Kangaroo Through Array, as I will explain later. And here's the summary of Kangaroo 2 results. And already Felix mentioned some of these, but as a result, some of them are confirmed by the Hess experiments, but NGC 253 Starburst Galaxy, our Hess upper limit is significantly lower than our detection, so it's a there still exists an inconsistency. On the supernova remnant RXJ1713, we first saw a signal from via our 3.8 meter telescopes in 2000, and then with a 10 meter telescope we published again. But also, these are the significance maps and not proportional to the flux, so you should care. Anyway, at this point, at this time, the telescope was a single dish telescope, so making a two-dimensional map is not an easy task for this kind of telescope. So, in that paper, we thought the flux is best explained by the Pi-Zero model and not by the inverse Compton model. But there's a claim by Paul and Bart that our prediction by the Pi-Zero component is contradicts the detection of flux of nearby 3 EG source, J7014. But if we change the spectrum index a little, this kind of limit can be avoided. So, so in anyway, the conclusion is not so different from what our original claim, as if we consider the test result, as Felix explained yesterday. So the Hess lacks is a little flatter than ours, and their results show no bending like this. On the galactic center, this was discussed extensively by Jim, so I may be skipped. But anyway, our spectrum differs significantly with Hess, and if we think this is a signal from the neutrality annihilation, as Dieter Horn says, the mass of neutrinos differs significantly, like 1 TeV in the kangaroo case and 18 TeV in the Hess case. 18 TeV is heavier than most theorists believe, I think. So anyway, it's not simple to explain the galactic center signal as a neutrino annihilation. Next, PSR 2012-59-63, and I could not bring the previous 3.8 meter telescope observation here, but again, in 2000, we observed this binary systems, but due to the various things, we could observe it only a little far from the periastron, like this point and this point. And we also calculated some prediction of the light curves along this eccentric orbit. And our observations are upper limits are here and barely limiting this predictions. But in one of the model, there are some assumptions here written. I cannot explain to, in detail here, but some model predicts two bump curves. Yeah? And this may be a possible explanation of the Hess light curve, as Felix showed yesterday.
Can I ask you something about all the previous slide where you were talking about the neutralino annihilation in the galactic center? Is there any information on the viability of the galactic center? Because neutralino annihilation should be solved.
Yes, yes. This was an observation based on 2001 and 2002. And our prediction is something like 7 sigma, so we just divided it into year by year, but the flux was stable. Mm. And Hess has more statistics, and their results show no variation.
So the difference in spectra is must be attributed to a difference in calibration, or
something? So, anyway, this is not a problem. This is an unsolved problem. And we looked up our data again and some kind of systematics there, but still we could not find any reason to explain the difference. And anyway, this year, we observed the galactic center again with 4 telescope array. Then we have to revisit the problem. This is a result of one telescope, a single telescope. And we have to confirm it with a stereo observation. And supernova remnant RXJ 08852. This is a so-called Vela Junior. And we published the results this year from the single telescope observation. But Hess has recently claimed the detection of this supernova remnant, as you heard yesterday from Felix. And you see the diameter of this supernova remnant is 1.5 degrees or something like that. So, and for this detection, we could see only one portion of the supernova remnant. And Hess has a wider field of view, and they could produce this kind, such kind of beautiful map. But still, there's a problem in the spectral index. Our spectrum is very steep, similar to the case of a galactic center. And the Hess spectrum has E times E to minus 2.2. And again, there's a...
This is for RXG
1760. Ah! Sorry, I yes, you're right.
This is your right.
I could... Yeah. I took the wrong one. But still, it was something like 2.2 or 2.4?
2.1.
The fluxes are weird, so energy...
So they cross around 1 TeV or something.
So the discrepancy is always below the TeV?
Yes. Main.
Yeah, above the reward.
What does the galactic plane look like in this region? Is it very bright, or because I wonder, you know, at the galactic center, there's, if this was, you know, single telescope data, you know, there's this big brightness difference on and off source, and you get nasty systematic errors from night sky brightness. Is mm-hmm. there something similar maybe here for very low?
Night sky background is a little better than the case of galactic center.
Okay. It's not quite as bad.
The possible problem is there's a Vela. Not here. It is near the galactic plane. Yes, it is, but not bad as a case of galactic center.
So, do you have any source of flux spectrum? All your spectra are steep. You have at least one source of flux spectrum.
Anyway, Crab is there, and Crab flux is
even that is
consistent. Yes, consistent. But I'll explain that. Come to that point again later. And for this supernova remnant, multi-wavelength data is sparse, and there's a Parkes radio data here and ASCA data here. And if we want to explain this emission via inverse constant, the normal prediction is like this. And to explain this, the magnetic field should be small compared to the normal prediction. And if we assume pi zero spectrum, we could fit it. But in the case of pi zero fitting, the synchrotron spectrum and pi zero spectrum could be treated in different ways. So in that sense, we can increase one parameter here, so we can fit it. So it's not a strong constraint here, I have to say. So I turn to the present status of Kangaroo 3, and our array is four telescope with one in the corner of a shape of diamond. And again, the telescope itself is themselves are very similar, and 114 mirror segments for each telescope. And the camera is different. The first telescope has a camera with more about 500 phototubes, but newer three telescopes has a larger field of view telescope camera with 427 channels each.
Are those parabolic reflectors? It doesn't look like there's continents.
This is a parabolic.
It's parabolic?
Yes, parabolic.
And then you have like point, with the new cameras you must have like 0.2 degree pixels or something.
Yes, exactly 0.168.
0.168.
Mm.
Okay.
And for new, older one, 0.12.
Oh.
And our electronics is a standard PDC plus ADC system, and not a flash ADC type, but a integrated ADC.
You're not using the time over threshold thing anymore for the ADC?
No.
Is that still on T1 or
For T1 we added ADCs later on.
So the results of like the galactic center and stuff are with ADCs or with the time over threshold?
Yes.
ADC?
So time over threshold, we do not use anymore.
Mm. But it's not in the old results, like the galactic center.
So you have parabolic design, so what is the point stress function?
Mm-hmm.
1 degree, 2 degree, should not be so good.
I'll mention that later. So we started in 1990, and then 10-meter telescope started in 2000, and other three telescopes were constructed in the past a few years. And here's a sample of four-fold stereo coincidence events. And you see, you may see that the shape of camera is different for number two, number three, number four telescopes and first telescopes. And now we are still tackling with stereo analysis. And as you heard, there's inconsistency with test results on sources. So our manpower is not big so enough to reanalyze the old detections by Kangaroo 1 and Kangaroo 2. So we are concentrated on the stereo analysis. And we are now trying to measure more optical parameters and use muons for calibration. And we are again studying the Crab Nebula as a standard source. And now we are working with independent teams within the collaboration. So anyway, the telescope works as planned. So the star tracking is very accurate, less than 1 arc minute. And the point spread function is measured by the CCD camera, like this. In fact, the point spread function is something like 0.15 or 0.2, and surely worse than the Hess or Veritas telescopes.
But this is closer to the center of the camera.
Yes.
If you go 1 degree off.
Ah.
Because you have parabolic.
Yes, yes. I did not bring that plot here, but the point spread function itself gets worse than, say, 20% at 1.5 degree of axis. Not so bad as you thought, because our we are using a little bit you do different mirrors for each position. For the inner mirrors, the focal lengths are a little shorter.
So not exactly parabolic design.
In that sense, yes. So we somehow optimized this arrangement of small telescopes to get a better image. And as a calibration, we are using muon events. And good muon events are selected for this calibration purpose, which are the large arc and a good muon fit, wing fit.
What are the dark single pixels? Are those noisy dots or are those?
Those are the off-timing events. Most of them are night sky background.
So they're like bad PDC values? Or?
Yes, yes. We use PDCs to cut the data. So this good muon event shows its curvature distribution is as expected. It should be 0.8 in inverse degree if they are muons, local muons. And we can use length over size distribution as a reflectivity parameter to calibrate our device. And these are compared with the Monte Carlo simulation. And this is a wing fit chi-square and curvature and size over arc lengths. And as I said, this size over arc lengths is proportional to the total light collection efficiency, including the mirror reflectivity and hot multiplier quantum efficiency, etc.
Which is the muon bump? This is size over arc length as opposed to length over size. So the bigger bump are muons and the...
So these are selected events. This is just our data on Monte Carlo.
It's nothing broad.
So we already use only a muon events.
Oh, that's the rod. Oh, I see. Based on some radius.
And in fact, we could see some deterioration of mirrors as a function of time, like this, and the total conversion efficiency decreases for about 5% per year. This this value could be recovered a little by washing the mirror surface by pure water, but it's not a easy task, so we do not wash every time.
It's about the aging of the last dynodes or anything like that?
Dynodes itself, there's a yes, such an effect, but this is the total. And now we can turn to the stereo observation. So many things are said yesterday and today, so I do not mention too much. But I just mentioned that we use theta square distribution as a signal indicator for this observation. Here, theta is an image intersection point, angle between the image intersection point and the target point. So the peak around theta square of near 0 degrees squared and shows the gamma ray signal is coming from that direction. And we would like to use the Crab Nebula as a standard source, but there is an unfortunate situation, I have to say. Because the first telescope, T1, has a 6 years old, and the energy threshold for this telescope is significantly higher than other three telescopes. That means the stereo efficiency of including this telescope is lower than other combinations. And the CLAB is observed at large Zenith angle from the lunar site. And the CLAB direction is in this here, in this direction. And for if we do not use the T1 telescope as coincidence, the stereo combination is seen from this direction is very short. That means the stereo reconstruction becomes bad for the this source. So, and if the signal, Cherenkov image is very near parallel, we cannot determine the intersection point. So we use only the we define the opening angle of two images of theta, and we reject events near parallel events. This is the expected distribution, but still there's a large asymmetry here. So our efficiency for CLAB nebula is not so good as expected. And still, we could see CLAB signal here. You see the statistics is not so good considering the certain hour observation. But the theta square distribution shows the signal, and the, for two telescope coincidence, the angular resolution is something like 0.16 degrees. And CLAB is there at the expected position, but the spread is, as I said, 0.16 degrees or something like that. And the CLAB... it has some minus 4 sigma points, but this is an artificial deficit caused by the star nearby. We just cut the high voltage to the photomultipliers near the star, bright star. That causes some artificial deficit here, I think. And the differential flux of the CLAB nebula is consistent with the Higgs ones. So this is 2.6. So for this case, we could get a standard spectral index. So
the line is the 2. Is the Hegre 2.6?
2.6.
Because it does look. No, I guess it's just a couple sigma difference, but it looks a little steep. Another upper limit point at the end or something, because that would be useful to plot to see if it looked too steep. You know, even if it were just an upper limit, it would still be interesting.
The problem is the statistics is not so good to divide the point into many points. And to save the situation, we devise the intersection point constraint fit. This is not easy to explain here, but we expect some the distance should be around 0.75 degree as expected. So if we constrain our fit to this function, the theta square distribution could be better than no fit case. And now we are trying to use a new method to discriminate gammas from hadrons, and using a so-called Fischer discriminant. Fischer discriminant is a linear combination of image parameters. Here, image parameter means width and length of each telescope. And they are added in linearly, but the coefficient of each image parameters are derived from the image parameters for a known source.
What is this Juno?
What?
What is the Juno?
Very old reference.
That's where Mangala published.
But still, but somehow it is available online.
It's online?
You can find it. And this is originally developed by to distinguish two groups of cows. And applying this Fisher discriminant, the signal-to-noise ratio becomes a little better. And the Fisher discriminant distribution is at the right position predicted by the Monte Carlo simulation. And you can hardly see the yellow line here representing the Higra to e to minus 2.6. Spectrum. Mm. It looks better, but here it is, the flux is in the integral one. So, and anyway, the spectral index is consistent with other things. And now I turn to the some of the results by the Kangaroo 3 stereo system. One is the Centaurus A. It is the nearest AGM, and the difference from the BL lux is it's a misaligned by 60 degrees, they say, but the distance is very near, so we tried to observe it, but we could not see a signal from this source. And our upper limit is something like 7% cloud. Not so strong, but still, still the best, well, the best limit ever reported. And some time ago, there were reports of the burst-like detection of this source by the Jansus collaboration and Buckland Park air shower array operated by the Adelaide University some time ago.
I say, what is this? Gridley's old point on this plot? Gridley.
Which instrument?
You know, there was a point where Gridley had instrument there in the 60s.
Yes, yes.
You don't have that point?
Because
the flux was so low, they had very good sensitivity, surprisingly, in those years. So. When often other groups are claiming that they don't confirm CNA comparing with Gridley, it was not very fair because his instrument really was very good. And the 300 GBA is threshold.
He actually saw something from the Galactic Center, I think, doesn't
he? Like a couple seconds. I've never seen what was detected. It was really a very nice instrument.
Anyway, we should plot it on the same base, yes. But I have to mention that here I wrote the reference, but I didn't plot. Anyway, their detection, they claim detection based on the observation of 72 and 74. So at that time, the Centaurus A was very active. This is a X-ray light curve from 1970. And our observations are like here, but still it is in the low state anyway. And now we try to extract some signal from the galactic diffusion issue. This is a galactic disk diffusion emission calculated by Stan Hunter. And here's a two-dimensional profile, and here is a longitudinal profile. And Northern Hemisphere experiments only saw this region here, and Higra the scan was constrained to this region. And still the most intense part was not observed until recently. Here's a spectra, and these are inlet points for longitude plus 40, 0, and minus 40 degrees. And as you may have heard, the index is harder than the cosmic ray value of minus 2.7, but similar to near to minus 2.5. And if we extend the this spectrum to TED energies, it could be barely detected. And here's a recently claimed Milagro 4.5 sigma detection around 1 TeV, and it is below the Higra upper limits reported earlier. And our last year, the observation timings was limited, so we did observation of this galactic disk only 2 points. One is L equal to 13 degrees, and another is minus 19.5 degrees. And for at this time, we used only two telescope core instances due to the hardware was not good to use a three stereo telescope core instance mode. But still, we could see some scanning results here. This is x-axis is galactic latitude, minus 5 degrees. And this is event rate after cutting some hadron-like events. And if we see a galactic plane along this line, it could be some Gaussian-like signal with RMS 1 degrees. So this is line is our upper limit line, fitting these all these points. But the upper limit itself is not so good compared with other experiments if we include many systematic errors. The limit on index of diffuse emission is somewhere like minus 2.2. So it's significantly higher than the Milagro detection points and etc. And on the galactic diffuse emission GED band, recently there are several considerations, so I just introduce a few of these. Some time ago, I wrote a paper on possible hard cosmic ray spectrum, and then there's a Poland Esposito discussed the possible contribution of inverse Compton emission to galactic diffuse emission. And only recently, there are new calculations by Kamaya et al., including the diffractive interaction and scaling violation using newer Monte Carlo code. And this is their calculation. This is a pi zero multiplicity per interaction, inelastic one in millibands. And experimental data are, they quote Chuck's old paper, 20 years ago. But they could fit this spectra, and their final results is here, and indicating the their predicted galactic diffuse emission is significantly larger than the original Hunter et al. Calculation. But still, you may see there's some excess in the calculation compared to inlet point here. So the problem is not completely solved anyway. And only recently, Isabel Grunier mentioned the new diffuse emission model, including the dark gas contribution. And this is taken from her poster paper presented at the Cherenkov 2005 workshop at the end of April. And she excluded the disk region plus minus 5 degrees in her plot, but still, if these dark gas contributions are included, egret source distribution becomes like this. So some of the egret 3 EG source catalog sources disappear in her new in her new model using his her diffuse model, including galactic dark gas.
I'm sorry, I missed the what's the physical meaning of the dark gas? Why could the sources disappear? I'm sorry, I get confused.
So she changed the diffuse model to analyze the egret sources. And her model uses some enhanced emission due to the dark gas contribution.
From WMAP, this isn't traced by the CO because apparently the dust is at such low temperatures, the CO isn't excited. So by using the WMAP at 100 to 1,000 micron, I'm not exactly sure where, maybe they find this new component, which is practically 50% of the dust mass, or of the gas mass, in the disk of the galaxy. It has all sorts of interesting implications. But one thing is that it takes away some of these unidentified sources that's being due to enhanced dust contributions. But this is published already in Science. Because of some cosmic ray interactions with this new dust target.
For some reason, the galactic plane itself is black
out. Yes, black out.
Why is that?
So, I do not know the exact reason.
She hasn't done the analysis yet. In principle, she can. Mm.
Because that would be very interesting here, like the galactic center region.
So, what's component is dust?
Yes.
Dust or native?
It's dark gas.
Very easy.
It's inferred from the cold dust at 100 to 1,000
miles.
But the interaction is not the dust is indicator.
I was under the presumption it was dust.
Because dust cold itself dust. Cannot contribute much to galactic production.
No, it's just the dust to gas ratio.
But you don't see it through 21 centimeter or CO?
21 centimeter is the atomic hydrogen, right? No, this would be all frozen out. But CO, the surprise is you don't see the CO emission because if you look at the excitation mechanisms at sufficiently low temperatures, the electrons are energetic enough.
The very dense source, they don't show up in 21 centimeter, they show up in molecular hydrogen or in CO or things like that, but they could probably not put the continuum.
So this is her analysis, or others agree with her?
I had a really long talk with Isabel about that, and she said that, it went through the two referees at Science who she claimed were very competent, and but it makes a lot of implications, for example, upon the gradient of supernovae cosmic ray contribution in the outer galaxy, because now, if you have an additional mass target, then it changes all those ratios.
But I have to say, this alters the galactic diffuse emission map itself. But it's just a target density, so the spectrum itself does not change by this dark gas contribution. So, and now we use our Fisher discriminant analysis to the Vela Junior supernova remnant, and we could somehow obtain a map like this. Still, the emission points are near the X-ray maximum point. And
have you just done one pointing, or have you tried to cover the remnant? As Felix said, it's like a 2-degree remnant.
For that observation, we use a Wobble mode, just counting 0.5 degrees.
You not a scan. Try to move around the whole
thing. Not yet. So, what I want to say is, map is by the Hess group is not so different from our new ones. And now we are analyzing the supernova remnant 1006 data with our stereo observation. For some 2,000 minutes observations, our preliminary analysis shows no signal from the supernova remnant. And for this analysis, we use cuts very similar to the ones applied to the Crab Nebula analysis. So, and also we are trying to see the Vela pulsar signal at the pulsar position and the kangaroo position. It is shifted by 0.1 degrees from the pulsar position, but still we could see, for this new observations, we couldn't see a signal. And
you're searching for point light source, right?
Pardon?
You're searching for point light source.
Yes.
It will be extended.
Could be. So we have to enhance the analysis. Yeah. Anyway, this is very preliminary. Anyway, so we could only use search for 2 points. And now we introduced a global trigger system just recently. Last year we observed our telescope in independent mode, and later we reconstruct the stereo events using timing information. Now the telescopes are triggered at very low threshold level, and by a hardware, if there's no coincidence within, say, several hundred nanoseconds, the telescopes are reset so that we can accept lower energy events compared with independent mode. This is the case. This is the situation is similar as Felix explained yesterday. Multiple coincidence mode, we can get a lower threshold energy compared with the independent mode. And then this is the length over size spectrum. And without this new trigger, there's you can see a bump caused by muons. But with this global trigger system, muon bump disappears almost completely. So we can reduce the energy threshold further. And so the dead time becomes very smaller compared with the global trigger. So before we have to operate at the very low trigger rate, at say less than 100 Hertz, but now we can operate it at a local trigger rate of 2,000 or 3,000 Hertz. So we expect the spectra, we can extend the energy threshold to lower level. So summary, we have been carrying out four telescope stereo observations since last March, 2004 March, but still we have some trouble in the first telescope with higher energy threshold. So, so the calibration of the Crab Nebula takes a little longer time than we expected. But we could get a preliminary results on Vela Junior supernova remnants, etc. And the Kangaroo 1 source, like supernova PMO6 and Vela Pulsar, our new telescopes did not see a signal from those sources. And we have to analyze for other sources, including TSR-1706 and Galactic Center, etc., by our new stereo telescope system. Okay, that's all.